Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One. Thank you very much for joining us this Sunday afternoon. And as a reminder to those who are joining us live, make sure and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. There you'll find the chat room. That's a great place if you have some observations about the show you'd like to make or would like to suggest a question for Eagle One or myself there to engage with our guest. We'll both be monitoring that during the course of the show, and that's a great venue to do it. And you could also say howdy to our very own Boston Maggie, who I see in the chat room directly from Beantown. Welcome, as always, Miss Maggie. And if you're new to Midrats and you want to catch up on some previous shows, or if you have to leave halfway through this show, you could always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. Now let's get on with the show. And I think the events of the last week have, if nothing else, brought us back to the front of the national conscious, what really has never left us in well over a decade or longer, depending upon where you want to draw the line. And that is the lack of a better description, the long war that is still going on. As a nation and generally as the West, we face threats that are both domestic, foreign, and increasingly a mixture of both. Communication transportation has created an environment where these transnational entities motivated for either religious reasons, philosophical reasons, or their own self-interest, are able to act and create effects on a much larger scale than from the, at least from appearances, the effort they put into it. What we'd like to do today, in some ways, starting out and then working our way into the central problem, is look at what are some of the lessons that we should take in the last decade plus that we've been engaged in this phase of the long war, that we might be able to mitigate an ongoing threat that will continue to be with us. And as we look forward to our second decade after 9/11/2001, what are the things that we have put into place that are working well, that are working appropriate for the type of nation that we are? What are some things that we should have done that perhaps we have not, and why we may have done it? And what are those things that's coming into visual range that we should do going forward that will better mitigate the odds that more of these events will take place? And to discuss this and perhaps a bit more for the full hour today will be Stephen Bucci, Ph.D., Colonel, United States Army, retired. He is the director for the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Prior to work at Heritage, Dr. Bucci, he served for three decades, mostly in Army Special Forces with what we call the Navy shore duty at Pentagon and various staffs. And when he left the Army, he was a consultant, the lead consultant to IBM on cybersecurity policy. He's published numerous articles on related issues, and he also was a regular contributor to Security Debrief, which is a leading national security blog. You can find a link to that over on my show page if you haven't had a chance to visit there. And he is also a sought-after speaker on conferences on security policy, and some of our previous guests have served and watched him on previous panels. And from military background, he was a commander of 3rd Battalion, 5th Special Forces during deployments to East Africa, South Asia, and the Persian Gulf. He's also included Operation Desert Thunder in 1998 in response to Saddam Hussein's threats in the no-fly zone over Iraq. Steve, welcome to Midrats.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Great. And part of your bio that I also wanted to mention, because I think it plays in a good scene setter for today's show, because you're one of those people that has a good depth of perspective, and that a few weeks before 9/11 of 2001, you had arrived to your latest duty station on the personal staff of Secretary Rumsfeld. So as you were getting your footing in that job, you saw 9/11. You've been intimately involved both in uniform and out in our responses to that initiating action back in 2001 that's led us through to where we are today. And if you look back at the course of the last decade plus we've been engaged at, and then you look at what happened recently in Boston, where though the terrorist elements have attempted other attacks, they have been a little bit unlucky, and we've been a little bit good at preventing them. They finally did get what they wanted. But looking at what happened in Boston, what are some things you think back in 2001 have remained fairly constant, but what are some of those things that we have done since then that perhaps mitigated the fact that we have this Boston attack here in 2013 and we didn't have it perhaps a few years earlier?
Well, Sal, there's two aspects to this that I both think are both important. One is, I think clearly our response to this specific event was much more coherent. There was much more cooperation between the different agencies. There was a lot less, oh my God, what just happened kind of response, which I think on 9/11, I mean, we were just shocked that, you know, we had this attack here in the homeland. I used to joke, you know, I went to war that day in my polyester dress pants and Corfam shiny shoes. Not what a Green Beret is supposed to go to war in. So, you know, that one caught us totally by surprise. This one, I think, surprised us, but I think our response was much faster and much more coherent. What I think is a really important point for us to pay attention to, though, is on 9/11, within 24 hours, we were putting together a system that would make us far safer from that sort of attack at any time in the future. I mean, we at the Pentagon put together what we call Operation Noble Eagle, which is the response to any sort of airplane-like event like happened on 9/11 with scrambling fighter jets and that sort of thing. And I can talk later if you want about, you know, a real-life one that occurred about 8 or 9 months after 9/11 and how the system actually worked. But the just bottom line is we were much less likely to get hit with another one of those attacks on September 12th than we were on September 11th. The problem with what happened in Boston this week is we have now shown the world by this attack and by its ability to be successful, regardless of whatever we figure out the final motivations of these two brothers were, whether they had connections overseas, whether they just did it through self-radicalization, or whether they just decided they didn't like marathon runners. I don't think that last one's terribly likely, but regardless, we are more vulnerable now because everybody understands that these very open, soft target type things that we do so many of in America are potentially lucrative targets. That's sort of a scary thing, and hopefully the security folks, the law enforcement, the intel, the military, everybody understands, and most important, the public understand that, yeah, there's a price for all of our freedom and openness, and that's that there's some additional risk that goes with it. I'm not saying that's a, you know, that we should change anything yet. We can talk about that, but it is a fact that we are more vulnerable today because now all the bad guys around the world looked at that and they went to school on us on that, and they are now going to try and use that to their advantage.
Well, to follow up on that a little bit, I mean, about 2 years ago, I think it was, Osama bin Laden and his crowd had come up with a theory that instead of the big attacks like 9/11, 2001, that one way to approach the U.S. was through what I think a tax of 1,000 cuts, or you know, they're going to bleed us by these little attacks and cause us to shut down. I mean, are we seeing that? I know that you had an article that that you had where you reported like 50 terrorist attacks that had been thwarted or had happened in the U.S. since 9/11. Are we seeing the beginnings, perhaps, of that 1,000 cut routine?
Well, the bad guys have been trying. You're right. Heritage has a thing. I think we're up to 54 foiled attacks by Islamic extremists against the United States. 54 of them that we've stopped. The Nidal Hassan attack was considered successful. He killed a bunch of innocent Americans. That one, isn't on that list. So there's really, that's 55 attacks that people tried, one that got through, and now this one, which I believe in the long run we're going to find out has at least some tie to Islamic motivation, whether it was self-developed or developed by someone else. But the key is, that in the past they've kept trying to do all this stuff on airplanes, and we sometimes out of luck, sometimes out of skill, we stopped them. The police and the FBI have tripped up a bunch of these guys by doing stings on them and stopping them from doing things. But in this case, these guys showed that, these big public events like marathons, parades, festivals, ball games are a little bit different. You have some control over the venue, but that's in big sports stadiums. What do you do at the high school games, at the little league games? All these very open events that we have in America, and none of us want to change the way we do them, but unfortunately the bad guys now know that those are potential targets, that even with all the effort that the Boston PD did to secure that venue, a 26-mile-long open sports venue in the middle of an American city, it is impossible to secure it 100%.
Steve, you brought up a great point. Earlier today, I was exchanging some ideas with a friend of mine, doing what we enjoy doing so much, just putting on our red hat. And, when you look at it from that point of view, what happened in Boston was a very successful operation. Obviously, they need to work a little better on their phase four and exfiltration plans, unless the two brothers had other ideas that just didn't pan out. But you had a couple of backpacks, two individuals. It wasn't a mass casualty event if you're looking strictly at deaths, so there were some horrific injuries, which of course is part of the plan. But what they managed to do is they managed to shut down an entire city. A major metropolitan area came to a full stop. Luckily, we had a real life 24 that was able to resolve it pretty quickly. But I think one of the big takeaways, one thing I'd like to ask you, is looking at it while wearing the red hat, I mean, shutting down that entire metro area in pursuit of one man. I know some people were praising it, but I think another way to look at it, by doing that, don't we in effect enable the enemy, however you want to define them? Aren't we enabling and giving a positive effect that they want to create, one of their desired effects, we enabled and actually accentuated, as opposed to not letting it completely shut us down? Because if you look at, an operation of two individuals, arguably expendable, you replicate that over a few cities and a few of those very open events, which you can very easily get to, that's pretty efficient method of getting your desired effects. Are we playing into their hands by having that type of reaction?
Well, I in a sense, yes, we are. But, I don't see that we have any particular choice. You have to, when an event like this occurs, we're already accepting risk by keeping those open venues going, by continuing to do life as normal for the most part for the American people. But after an event like this occurs, there is a responsibility. You got the protective responsibility beforehand, but then you've got the responsibility of catching these guys and keeping them from doing any follow-on events. We're going to have to accept some degradation to our normal life to catch them. Now, if you're talking about closing down an American city and locking it up for weeks at a time, I don't think that would have happened. I think at a certain point the leadership would have made the decision, okay, this guy's either gone to ground and he's not coming out anytime in the immediate future, or he's moved to somewhere else. We're going to have to go back to business as usual. But, you know, fortunately, the FBI and the Boston PD and all the other agencies that were part of the effort to find these guys managed to do it in about as expeditious a manner as I think anyone could have hoped for. So I think today, if you ask the people of Boston, you know, could you put up with that inconvenience to catch those bad guys? I think they'd probably, a majority would say, yeah, I think we can.
You know, one of the things that we need to look at is the character of the people who commit crimes like this. And I was kind of surprised because I thought, well, these have to be disaffected, poor guys, uneducated, who are thrust in this position. But I was reading a piece in the counterterrorism thing from West Point about the people who do commit some of these incidents or have committed some of these incidents or been arrested for trying to commit them. And they're usually fairly well-educated and not from especially impoverished backgrounds. How do we track, is there a way to track who might be susceptible to a message that would cause them to do this?
It kind of depends. If you talk to the Israeli security forces, you know, they do a lot of profiling of who might be used by, some of the Palestinian groups against them. And they do find that in some cases the foot soldiers, the ones carrying the actual suicide vests, are poor, disaffected people. They've had several instances where they were people that were mentally ill. They try and find someone vulnerable that they can either leverage to do this stuff or, you know, that don't know any better. But usually the people who do the planning, not necessarily the masterminds, but the mid-level management, they're not poor people. They're not uneducated. They're folks who have enough on their mind that they feel that, you know, the academic term is relative deprivation, where they think they should have more. They have this expectation that maybe they should have a better job, maybe they should be, running the world, and they're not. So they take that dissatisfaction, and it really, really cranks them up and makes them open to this kind of radicalization and action against what they feel is the party that's causing them this grievance. Even if you look back, prior to the idea of doing this just for pure terrorism motivated by religion, if you look at insurgents in general, Fidel Castro was a very, very educated man. He was a college graduate. Most of the guerrilla leaders that you find, at least in modern history, were not, they're not Spartacus, some poor slave that rises up. They're middle class, in some cases upper middle class folks, who feel that they should be in charge, so they take whatever action they need to do it. And I think we're seeing a similar dynamic here with these kind of, I know the term is lone wolf. I'm not sure if that's a good term to use anymore. But these, in some cases, self-radicalized people who then decide to take action.
When I was thinking about these two guys and trying to compare it to other events that we've seen, when you look at the background and the intellectual nature of these guys, it reminds me in many ways of the London attacks, the types of individuals that made those attacks. So obviously this wasn't a suicide attack. And you brought up one of the terms that we've heard a lot recently thrown around, and there's obviously a lot of speculation going on. First, second, and third reports are often wrong, but we hear the term lone wolf. We've, in the last 36 hours, discussions of sleeper cells, and people are always referring to, no, it's not Al-Qaeda, but Al-Qaeda affiliated organizations. What are those different terms, and how do they represent the ecosystem of potential threats that we have here inside the U.S. boundaries?
Well, you know, the one that is very concerning, and the one that, frankly, you know, since 9/11 we've focused on, is the sort of commando team is the wrong word, but the group that comes into the United States from someplace else. They're trained, they're radicalized, they're really into the movement, and they come to the United States under some other pretext. They come here, they may live here for a little while, but, you know, they got here with a mission, and then they just got to get together to execute it. The 9/11 hijackers were the prime example of that. Then you go to the sleeper cell type thing, people that are here for much longer time, but they were sent here either with a mission ahead of time or at least told, go there, become part of the society, you know, look like an American, act like an American, live among them, and we're going to contact you at some point and have you do something. Those people, again, are already true believers when they get here. Some of them have a mission ahead of time. Some of them, you know, get given orders later. Then you drop down to these groups that are becoming much more prevalent. They're Americans, maybe they're second or third generation immigrants from the countries, you know, Pakistan, somewhere like that. In this case, these kids from Chechnya. And even though they don't have direct contact with this outside terrorist group, with Al-Qaeda or one of their other folks, they feel themselves, they buy into the ideology, they read Inspire magazine, the online magazine of Al-Qaeda, they go to the jihadi websites, they listen to the sermons that are there, they watch the videos of terrorist attacks from the past and in other places, and the bug just sort of bites them, and they decide, okay, I'm going to be a part of this movement now. I've seen what they do, I've seen how they do it, I understand what they believe, at least they think, and then they decide to take action. And that's what happened in Madrid, that's what happened in London, and that's what happened, I believe, here in Boston. And the guys in Times Square, similar activity. Nidal Hassan, you know, despite the army's ridiculous characterization of that as workplace violence, he was a self-radicalized terrorist who went out and killed American military personnel. The fact that he was in the American military already is not a relevant fact to whether or not he's a terrorist. So similarly, you know, they self-radicalize and they take action. Now, the difference between Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda affiliates, you know, we have the original Al-Qaeda Central, as we like to call them now, the original group, very much true believers, very much adherents to the philosophy of Osama bin Laden, and with a dedication to attacking America, initially because of, you know, what he considered the grave crime of entering Saudi Arabia. Didn't matter that we were invited there to help liberate Kuwait. He just held that against us ever since and declared war on us. Now, since then, since Al-Qaeda Central has been so beaten down, so attacked and successfully by our efforts over the last 10-plus years, these other groups have popped up. They may have already been existing, or they may be new, that formed and then voluntarily said, we believe the same thing that they do. We like Al-Qaeda. We think their ideas are correct and valid, and we're going to fight the same way and for the same cause. And that's, we refer to them as the affiliates. They're, you know, not like they get a franchise agreement or anything, but they have identified themselves with Al-Qaeda. They don't necessarily take orders, operational orders, directly from Osama bin Laden's, you know, buddies now that he's dead. But they try and plow the same ground, and that means attacking us. With this group, it's kind of going to be interesting to see as the investigation continues whether the older Sarnoff brother had contact with an affiliate when he was overseas on this last trip that he took to Russia, or, you know, was he just over there seeing his dad? We don't know. You know, did they become radicalized? Because there is some evidence from, you know, reading the tweets of the younger brother that he was getting more and more radicalized. Did that just happen from the internet, or was there someone here who was handling them or working with them to try and radicalize? We don't know yet. That part of the investigation is not done. So these guys will be an interesting case study to see where, you know, how this happened, what caused them to take this action, and how we can then fight it in the future. It's a very, very difficult task for our law enforcement and security personnel because, again, we don't want to change our lifestyle. We don't want to give up the freedom and the openness that makes America the most attractive country in the world for anyone in the world to come to. I don't think any of us that are citizens want to give that up. But we've got to ensure that our security forces can also adequately protect us from these people. And that's a very tough balance that the leaders of this country have to continue to dialogue and frankly, argue about until we can get a balance that we can all agree with.
You put up a kind of a background brief on the Heritage site about things, among other things, we shouldn't do as a result of an attack like this. One of the things you were concerned about was throwing money at the problem. Could you kind of explain what you meant by that and why we shouldn't do that?
Well, we, you know, right after 9/11, everybody, you know, everybody wanted to contribute. Everybody wanted to try and fix the problem. Everybody wanted America to be safer. And Congress and the Bush administration, we're all pretty much, you know, it doesn't matter what the cost is, we've got to fix the problem. And the easiest way, seemingly, to do that is to spend more money on the solutions. But I think, particularly with the economic woes that we're facing right now, we can't be that cavalier. We may need to spend more money on certain technologies, things like that, but we sure as heck need to do it smartly and with focus and not do it, you know, like a shotgun effect all over the place. You know, I know this will bother some people, but security spending cannot be a sort of way to spread the pork around the country. If there is no legitimate threat to certain parts of the country, then perhaps we should spend less money there than we do on places that are much more likely targets. You know, the DHS grant system, which, you know, I understand the idea. We wanted to help everybody get more secure, but we spent a heck of a lot of money on places where it's very, very unlikely. I won't say impossible because that's, you get in trouble whenever you say that. But it's very, very unlikely that an enemy might attack someplace like that. You know, in the middle of the prairie, you know, is probably not a good place for a terrorist attack. So do we really need to spend money on counterterrorism equipment out there that money might be better spent somewhere else?
One thing when it became apparent who these attackers in Boston were, that just I kept trying to wrap my head around. Back in late 01, early 02, you know, one of the big briefing items and concerns as things were scattering out of Afghanistan were the Chechens. Of all the, you know, Star Wars bar scene collection of nationalities that were in Afghanistan pre-9/11, it was the Chechens that concerned everybody because they're pretty brutal, pretty effective what they do, and have been pretty radicalized due to their exposure to the Russians' counterterrorism actions. And I think everybody, including myself, they love Uncle Ruslan. And you know, we have some Chechens near where I live, and they're great, hardworking individuals. But if you're trying to mitigate outside terrorists coming in, I was a little gobsmacked to see that we had an individual of Chechen Extraction, who was known to have become radicalized to the point that the FBI was concerned enough with him to interview him a couple of years ago, that there's not more attention being given to the Chechens. Maybe I'm making an incorrect assumption here. Not all sources of immigration and not all backgrounds are equal. Do we have our domestic intelligence services, such as the FBI, do they have the right procedures in place to be able to triage their attention to where you're most likely to find people, or do we still have work to do on, I'll use the word, profile appropriately in line with the way the Israelis do, in order to protect the American public so that finite resources, which are FBI agents' time and effort, are being expended towards those who are most likely to become radicalized and deadly as a result?
Well, since they failed in this case, I guess you could say, no, we didn't do it exactly right. We let a lot of Chechen refugees into our country. They're frankly in countries all over Europe. People, despite the reputation of the Chechens as some very, very hard people, we had seven of them at least down in Gitmo for a while. I believe there's at least one more still in Gitmo. They have a reputation, the ones that are radicalized, not every Chechen, but the ones that are radicalized, as being pretty tough, brutal, hard people. The attacks that occurred in Russia, particularly the school in Beslan, horrific violence that just petrified everyone. Everybody was just horrified by it. But on the other hand, there was a lot of sympathy for them because of the way, that they had been treated. Leveling the city of Grozny with artillery as a counterinsurgency technique is that's not the way we do it. But we had a lot of inherent sympathy for the Chechen people because of that. I think that sympathy probably caused America, even post 9/11, to give them a little slack, which you just can't do when you're doing these kind of investigations. You've got to have a very, very steely eye on who is who and who might be who. And even if the tip comes from the Russians, who, we haven't been getting along with that well in the last few years, especially since Mr. Putin came into power and is trying to play hardball with everybody, we can't just blow that off. In this case, this is the one thing that probably will get a lot of investigation, is what was said by the Russian government to our security folks and what wasn't, and what did we do with the information, who kept it, who passed it on, and how was it used to do more than just have an interview with the kid. I think that's going to get a lot of scrutiny. Obviously, whoever did the interview didn't set off the right alarm bells, or perhaps this would have been stopped. But again, you have to be careful with, there's thousands and thousands of different refugee groups and immigrant groups here in America. 99.9% of all of them are wonderful people who came here because they'd really like to buy into the American dream, just like you and me. But that 0.1% that have another agenda, or who develop another agenda at some point in their lives, they can kind of wreak havoc on both the reputation of their fellow countrymen and on the people of the United States. So, yeah, I think the process by which we scrutinize immigrants, both getting visas and then after they get here, is probably going to go up. And one hopes that doesn't become outright profiling, but, to be honest, at a certain point, if the bad guys are all coming from certain groups, those groups should get more scrutiny. I know that's not terribly politically correct, but come on, that's common sense. We've got to at least give our law enforcement folks some leeway when they have some evidentiary basis for it to dig a little deeper. Even if you don't have the evidence to take somebody to court yet, but we need to be able to allow them to do their job of protecting us without giving up all of our rights, but with an ability not to, you know, have them be so worried about what they're doing that they don't do it and then miss something.
You know, as I was watching the coverage, I was sort of surprised by the fact that no radical Islamist group in, you know, East Out or Peshawar or someplace didn't immediately stand up and say, that's our guy, we did this. Now, is that, and then I had two thoughts on that. One was, is that because they've learned that if they stick their heads up and start crowing about it, they get a Hellfire missile down their throats? Or is, as I was reading on the Memory website this morning, is that because this was a totally I'll use the word lone wolf again, but this was a one-off attack by a couple of guys who just happened to decide to do this on their own, however they got to that position?
I think that's a very good question that there's a lot of people trying to come up with the answer to. Normally by now, someone, you know, would have claimed credit for this if they had been the ones to motivate these guys. No one's done that yet. While there is some circumspection on the part of these bad guys as far as our ability to, you know, pop them if they do something like that, I can't imagine that they would have, you know, been able to hold off too much longer than this. I honestly think, and again, this is just speculation, I don't have access to any of the classified stuff, but I think we're going to find that this probably was mostly self-radicalization. Maybe the older brother, you know, had someone sort of encourage him or point him in the right direction on that last trip. I'm not sure we're going to be able to track this back to either an AQ affiliate or AQ Central. It may just be that these kids decided they were going to join the jihad from here in the belly of the great Satan, and they, you know, lived in that area, so they decided to go for the Boston Marathon. I can't imagine the bad guys overseas holding back this long without saying something.
Yeah, if I had to put a paycheck on it, I think that would be pretty much my feelings as well. It doesn't. If you're looking at a couple of motivated people who are intelligent, as both of these men were, it doesn't take much to do what they did. I think that's probably where the smart money is going to go. Speaking of smart money, I guess timing is critical in all things. I understand at the end of the week, last week, you were attending an anti-terrorism conference up in New York City. Who was there at the conference, and what were some of the big takeaways that you took from the conference?
Well, I appreciate you giving me a chance to talk about that a little bit. This was a conference that I was invited to literally a year ago. It goes on every year around this time. Had, you know, nothing to do with specific events. It's actually designed to support an organization called the Mobile Trauma Unit in New York City. This is a volunteer medical organization led by a guy who is the head of the trauma unit in one of the big New York hospitals. And they, all these doctors, nurses, techs, volunteer. They've raised money to get equipment, and they can show up at a scene. The Secret Service uses them a lot on standby for the big UN events, and basically do any sort of major trauma surgery on scene. They don't even have to move anybody to a hospital, whether it's amputations or anything. And so it was a great event that they put on. And one of the speakers that came in that wasn't on the original agenda was the doctor who was the one running the medical tent at the Finish Line in Boston. He's actually a family practice doctor, not an ER doc or a trauma doc. but he sort of does all the marathons. He used to run marathons, and now he's sort of the go-to guy. He's runs the medical coverage for the New York Marathon. He's done it for Boston for several years, several other national-level marathons. So here is this guy describing to all of us, the audience, mostly law enforcement, a lot of firefighters, EMTs, a few military folks, describing the carnage that he and these other medical people had to deal with there. You know, they thought they were going to deal with pulled muscles, bad feet, dehydration, and, you know, maybe a heart attack, which is what they normally deal with. Instead, they had to run 100 meters down from their tent and deal with people whose legs had been blown off, other people who still had their limbs, but literally had the entire back of their legs, all of their thigh muscles and calf muscles gone. And it was a very, very moving event, because here is this guy sort of processing this experience in front of the audience. And normally an audience would probably be very uncomfortable having someone share that and see the emotion that he was going through. But because of who the audience was, these men and women who frankly have gone through similar experiences to what the doctor and his staff had to deal with, nobody moved. There was nothing but the looks on people's faces of like, yeah, brother, I hear you. Share it. Get it all off your chest. We understand. And to see the kind of people that we have in this country, the ones who do this for a living and the ones who unfortunately get thrown into the breach unbidden, it really makes you proud to see who we have in this nation ready to protect its citizens and take action when someone does do us ill.
I thought watching the tapes on TV that one of the most remarkable aspects of the event was after the explosion, the number of first responders, military people, and people, apparently veterans, some other folks who ran toward the incident rather than running away. It said a lot, I think, about where we are as a people and the kind of people that make up those the police and the fire and all those aid workers who, as you say, were down there at the triage section, which, you know, thank goodness they were there, because this could have been, we say we only lost three people at the bombing, but it could have been much, much worse if they hadn't been so close to adequate medical help.
Well, I think, just to throw this out, the one of the intro speakers at this conference made the comment, and he said, you know, it's really good to be here with this pack of sheepdogs. And it made me smile, because what he was referring to, and I don't know if you or your listeners have read Dave Grossman's book On Killing. Dave Grossman is a former Army Lieutenant Colonel, infantryman, who went on to become a psychologist. Phenomenal book about the psychology of violence that people have to deal with in these situations. Now, when he wrote that book, originally it was aimed primarily at the military. But with the advent of terrorism in our own homeland, you realize that the things he talks about are just as applicable to all of our law enforcement, all of our firemen, all of our EMTs, and unfortunately even to many of our citizens. And what he's referring to, and I'll give you the short version, is that he points out that the sheepdogs have a lot more in common with wolves than they do with the sheep. You know, just genetically, psychologically, everything. But for some reason, the sheepdogs decide to stand between the innocent sheep and the wolves that might hurt them. And the people that step up, the warriors, the policemen, the firefighters, the people who put themselves in danger, the ones you describe running towards the sound of the guns, those people are sheepdogs. They're willing to stand between the innocent and the people like these two young men who would hurt them and try and bring them to justice or to try and bring help and protection to those citizens. And I tell you, this country has an amazing reservoir of people like that. Many of them who wear uniforms of all sorts of different colors. Some of them are wearing regular clothes. But when the situation strikes, they step forward and they act as the sheepdogs to try and protect their fellow citizens. And that's something we should thank the Lord that we have, because unfortunately there are a lot of wolves out there.
Very well said, and it's something that should be encouraged. It's amazing the some people will hold back for reasons that are kind of silly, but I think that sheepdog instinct, when encouraged, it definitely brings more people out to help in situations like that. And I think my co-host was spot on. That was a great response in how it should be. I would feel, just to change subjects for a little bit, I would feel remiss, and I know some of our listeners would get grumpy with me if I didn't tap into another part of your background, which does tie into this in some ways, is what we saw in Boston was it was a heart attack, H-A-R-D, in that we have explosions, we have bodies, we have injuries, et cetera, and so forth. But there was also, as a secondary effect to that, a significant economic impact for the Boston area. Anybody who's a small businessman knows government was never going to reimburse you for those lost days, and that's the difference between being red or black for the month. And there is a soft underbelly to our economy with cyber attack. There's a lot of writing, a lot of speculation. Some fiction authors have made some good money on it. But there's, when it comes to cyber defense or even cyber attack, there's a good conversation going on between where are the firewalls and where is the right responsibility between the military and non-military entities in this nation, especially when it comes to cyber offense. And, you know, where do you see that argument going forward? And does industry, whether it's IBM, Duke Power, whatever, how comfortable are they having government entities, either military or civilian, getting into their servers, their mechanisms, their mechanical control devices, vice being able to defend themselves internally? How is that relationship going, and are the trends going in the direction that you feel they should be?
Oh boy, you opened up a can of worms. We don't have that many minutes left. Let me start with this, and then I'll segue to what your larger question was. First, imagine what happened in Boston. But instead of the kind of response we got, what if the bad guys had gotten some friends to help them and they did, a rudimentary cyber attack that took down the 911 system or the city communication system that are all internet-based now? Would we have been able to respond as effectively as we did if we had not had that ability and if the bad guys had done something with cyber means to augment what they did in the kinetic effect? That's a question that's very much on the minds of a lot of big city law enforcement types who worry that somebody's going to get inside their systems and cause them to not be able to respond with the kind of speed and fidelity that they normally do. Now let's jump to the bigger picture. Right now, we're having an enormous debate here in this country. Some people say it's a partisan debate, but frankly, that's a bunch of baloney. Every cyber bill that has been introduced by our Congress in the last year or so has had bipartisan support. And every single one of those bills has had bipartisan opposition. And because this is not really a partisan issue, everybody agrees we need to do something about cyber. But there's a great debate as to what that something should be. And some people who say, well, we need to do something because anything's better than nothing, are just, they're wrong, with all due respect. You can pass laws, you can put in place systems that will in fact be damaging to our cybersecurity, not improve them. I personally think a regulatory solution, like they tried to do with the cybersecurity bill of 2012, the so-called Lieberman-Collins Act, that was a regulatory-based system. They were going to pass government regulations, and frankly, this is what the presidential executive order is trying to do too, pass government regulations that set a minimum standard for what companies need to do to secure their networks. The problem with that is regulation is a 19th century style solution trying to deal with the ultimate 21st century threat, which is in the cyber realm. Cyber moves too fast. It's too agile. The bad guys are motivated, capable. They're checking and changing things all the time. And I'm sorry, the federal government's regulatory system will never be able to keep up with that. So we've got to get the private sector more involved. We've got to get them to help be part of the solution. And today, the private sector is very reluctant to share information beyond the most rudimentary stuff with a lot of the government entities. One reason is the information is not anonymized. So if my company turns over information, everybody will get to know that I turned it all this information, that I got hammered by some bad guy in the cyber realm. The information is I am liable. If I share that information with the federal government, my lawyers are going to tell me, hey, we could get taken to court because you shared information that somebody else, some customer, might decide was their private information. So I'd like to share it, but I don't because I don't want to get sued, and my lawyers all tell me not to do it. And then the last part is if I share that information, as soon as it gets in the hands of the feds, it's subject to FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act. So if I give them that information and some of it's my proprietary data, well, then my competitors can do a FOIA request and get it. We've got to exempt information that's shared from FOIA requests. And then the very last part of that is, frankly, the feds don't share the information back to the private sector very well. They do it slowly. They do it late. It's not done well, and their excuse is always, well, we got to protect sources and methods. Well, look, you guys are in the military. I was in the military. I was in the intel community for a long time. About 80% of the stuff that we say we can't share because we got to protect sources and methods, we could share with no problem and no one would be hurt. Nothing would be lost. We grossly overclassify that. We use that as an excuse because it's easier than making the decisions in the other direction. And we've got to get past that, only protect that last 20% that really needs to be protected, and the rest of it we need to share with alacrity so that people can get it and use it. And the one more element of this is, and you kind of alluded to it, is this sort of self-defense. Right now, the federal government, the FBI, they're working like madmen to try and help people with cyber attacks. They don't have enough people. They don't have the kind of numbers of folks that they need to do this. So there's a lot of times that the federal government just can't get there and can't help. Well, if you've got a capability within your company, either resident in it, or if you can hire somebody who has the capability to help you, why can't we pass a law that gives some ability to fight back? Right now, if I know somebody's hacking my system, I can't hack back on that guy because as soon as I do, I'm just as much a lawbreaker as he is. So if you're trying to get into my system and I booby trap some data that I know you're going to want because I want to find out who you are, and you grab that, take it back, and that malware gets on your system, I'm a criminal. And even though my whole purpose is to find out who you are, get your data, and turn it over to law enforcement, it doesn't matter. They can prosecute me under the law. Those kind of things are crazy. We've got to fix those. We need to have a good cybersecurity bill We haven't seen one yet that really does it correctly in my mind, but hopefully we'll keep working at it and we'll get there sooner rather than later.
Well, you wrote an article in 2009, I think, on the confluence of cyber and cybercrime and terrorism. You made some of these points, but I thought one was really good about you don't have to have a full attack to take everything down in the U.S. You need an event that would hit some area really hard. And as I was reading that thing, why are so many systems internet accessible? What is it that causes us to put things like power systems where they can be hacked and damaged? Is there an answer to that? Is that part of the system that needs, or the thought process that needs to fix access to some of this stuff?
Oh, no. I mean, in the past, SCADA systems, the industrial control systems, the things that run our power plants, our water plants, all those factories, everything, in the past, they always used to be idiosyncratic to that facility, so they were built specifically for that, and they were completely independent. They had no connection to the internet in any way, shape, or form. Today, even though most of them are still generally not connected to the internet, I can guarantee you the vast majority, if I get a couple of my really smart tech friends, that we can find somewhere where the administrative network of that facility kind of interfaces with the industrial control system, and therefore there's a route in from the internet. And why? Well, if you're Duke Power, it doesn't make sense to you from a financial standpoint, from an efficiency standpoint, to have every one of your power plants have its own system that isn't the same as all the rest of them. It's much more efficient to have them all have the same system and to have them networked so that maybe you only need one monitoring station rather than one in each plant. So for good economic and efficiency reasons, we've essentially built in vulnerabilities because everybody was looking for the efficiency, not for the security. We're going to have to relook that, but it's hard to go backwards to more inefficient systems rather than fix the security. I think we're going to have to fix the security with the systems we have, and that right now is an imperfect system and one that does have some risk associated with it.
One thing you mentioned earlier, and it is kind of self-contradictory, is there has been historically, because of the rather old-school counterterrorism techniques the Russians used against the Chechens, there's a lot of sympathy in this country towards the Chechens and some resistance in working closely with the Russians with that threat. As a result of the Boston attacks, should we expect the Russians, if they haven't already, to redouble their efforts to get assistance from us and helping them address the significant threat they have of Chechen terrorism? And if so, is that something that we should do? Look again at how we cooperate with the Russians, specifically towards the threat from the Chechen terrorist organizations?
Well, I think the first step will be to determine, you know, were these two young men connected with any outside Chechen organizations, or, you know, was it just Al-Qaeda, some more generalized terrorist threat, or were they operating essentially on their own, maybe with just some encouragement from someone overseas? That will be the first determination that has to be made. If it turns out that they were, you know, the agents of some larger Chechen terrorist group, there's going to be a lot of pressure for us to work with the Russians to try and to bring that organization to ground. It's difficult because the Russians do have such a different way of doing business than we do. They're a little more heavy-handed than we are, to put it mildly, and there will be a lot of resistance to working with them. The other aspect of it is, you know, we disagree on a heck of a lot of stuff still. They're not the Soviet Union anymore, but they're not exactly, you know, they haven't become the UK either. So there's going to be some circumspection before we start turning over information helter-skelter and before we start pulling triggers based on information that they've given us without independent confirmation. So I, if I was a betting man, I'd say you'll see some increase in cooperation, but I wouldn't think it was going to just be a massive exchange of information that opens up the floodgates in either direction.
Well, Steve, we're at the end of the show here, but I really want to thank you for coming on. And can you tell us what you're up to next? What can we look forward to from you in the next few weeks?
Well, we've got we're going to continue working cyber because we've got several bills that are coming through the Congress that we'll be opining on. Tomorrow I'm at the National Press Club doing a conference on bioterrorism and the bio threats that are out there. Unfortunately, there is no shortage of subjects for us to work on. Some of them we're happy to work on because they're things that our nation needs to deal with. Others, you know, we have to work on because there's a threat out there, and we've got to try and at least, from our opinion, fix what may be broken, and to be the loyal opposition to try and particularly defend defense. We're very concerned about where defense is going, and I know that's near and dear to you guys and a lot of folks that are listening.
Well, Steve, once again, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a real fast and informative hour. We really wish you the best, and we'll keep an eye on you and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
I appreciate you having me on, and I hope to come back again if you'll have me.
Yes, sir, and thank you very much for those who are joining us live or have caught us on the rebound. And please join us again for another edition of MidRats when we'll have as our guest Naval War College professor, Dr. Milan Virgo. Thank you very much. Have a great Navy Day.
Thanks, Steve.
My pleasure, guys. I enjoyed it. Hope it worked out okay.